See, so good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Journey Home with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson, and hi, Carrie and David, and all you folks out there on the radio, Delia. Good to see you all here this morning. We're doing the Journey Home, and it's a book by Ken Wapnick that discusses the obstacles to peace from A Course in Miracles, and so that's a pretty interesting section, and I'm learning a lot about my own willingness to make and keep obstacles to my own peace, which is insanity, as I'm sure Albert Einstein would have told us. Anyway, good morning, Bruce, and how are you today?
Good morning, Lynn. Well, and yourself?
I'm really well. I'm, still... still kind of allergy season-y, so I'm still snuffy and snorty, but I'm sort of like an elephant, as I think I always relate to elephants. probably not, but anyway, yeah, I'm doing well.
So
anything going on in Bruce world that we need to know about?
Well, I can't think of much.
just
been doing a lot of web stuff, but the usual weekly and monthly course things, including our conversation this morning. So looking forward to reading a few more pages.
Very good.
As always, yeah.
Yeah, so, and actually I'm looking forward to, at the end of this month, I'll be going to the Course in Miracles conference in Boston.
That's right.
I'll be a presenter along with my partner, Dove Fishman. And So I'm not sure about our schedule during that time. Usually, I have time in the morning to do our chats because the conference doesn't start until later. But this is on Eastern time, so there may be conference events because it would be like 10:30 in the morning. I may or may not be with you then, but
okay.
And we'll get along with that. And then the next week, right after the conference, I'm going to Denver to the it used to be Comic Con, but I guess San Francisco decided that they wanted to own that word Comic Con, so now it is I forget what it's called, culture something, pop culture conference or con.
Okay.
Yeah, Pop Culture Con or something like that. Or I don't know. Anyway, doesn't really matter. It's the same thing, basically. I guess if, you're kind of a nerd and you like that stuff, which I guess I am, then it's really fun.
Neat.
But, so it'll be interesting. I might be able to teach from before then because it's in Denver and we're staying at a B&B.
Okay.
Yeah, not a B&B. We're staying at a hostel in Denver. So that'll be an adventure also.
Yeah, because normally you'd think you'd want to stay at a friendly.
Yeah, I know. That's generally what I like. But no, I got to stay at a hostel this time.
But with your friend, with your forgiveness, expertise, you should be able to stay at a hostel and not be upset, right?
That's right, and maybe turn it into a friendly. It may start out as a hostel, but by the time I'm done, it will be a friendly. Yep. Oh my goodness! All right. So we are going through Ken Wapnick's book, The Journey Home, like I said, with talking about the obstacles to peace. And I put a bookmark where we were, but I'm not sure exactly. So I'm going to count on trusting your memory to start us out here.
Okay. I have us on page 54 in the print version. And that... I think we got, I'm trying to remember how far we get on the next page. I think we might have gotten down through the first few paragraphs. So I think I'm going to just back up a little, which is always helpful for context. So I'm going to go to the middle of the page, which is, I'll start with, about a third of the way down the page. And this is where Ken says, Ken Wapnick says, therefore, the egos of the people who knew Jesus identified with their individual selves, quote, what you believe you are, unquote. This need to protect their dualistic identification compelled them to regard his message of their non-dualistic identity as a grave threat. Their fear thus impelled them to attack and kill him. And then quotes, frightened people can be vicious, unquote, which is from chapter 3 in the text, section 1, paragraph 4, as the only way to preserve their individuality. And so the line from the text, quote, look not upon the little wall of shadows, unquote, is referring to the fact that we chose to look on the world of shadows as reality. And this is kind of wrapping up the section on the Plato's Allegory of the Cave that was in his classic work, The Republic. So I'll just start that paragraph again. And so the line from the text, quote, look not upon the little wall of shadows, unquote, is referring to the fact that we chose to look on the world of shadows as reality. But the real world, again, is a, quote, world, unquote, of light. It is still a thought within the separated mind, yet it is a thought washed clean by forgiveness and thus purified of all the darkened thoughts of sin and guilt. Then there's another quote where Ken will, of course, have his commentary. Only short paragraph of this quote. The quote is, the sun has risen over it. How can a shadow keep you from the sun? No more can you be kept by shadows from the light in which illusions end. And Ken comments, here we can say the sun has risen over the world of shadows, which would really be the sun of forgiveness. The passage, therefore, is speaking about experiencing ourselves, standing outside the truth, a shadow in the sun. But it continues by stating that this is really a symbol of the shadow of our illusions, a shadow of our guilt and hatred, which cannot keep us from the light of truth, from the light of Jesus' love. Do you want to read a little bit? I just wanted to say
something here about kind of back up. But the paragraph where he's talking about the real world,
mm-hmm.
and the real world again is a world of light. It is still a thought within the separated mind, yet it is a thought washed clean by forgiveness and thus purified of all the darkened thoughts of sin and guilt. And so, when Jesus talks about the real world in A Course in Miracles, a lot of times people think that that's heaven, and they, you know, they think that, you know, that when they get to that they will be in heaven. But in actuality, you're still in the dream in the real world. It's but the dream is no longer a dream of sin and guilt,
mm-hmm.
and fear. The dream is no longer a dream of fear. And so the difference between where you are right now, just assuming, you know, and this is night and day, dark and night, dark and light. And it reminds me of that Laurie Anderson, which I often say, she says, paradise is exactly like where you are right now, only much, much better. And I think about that because that's exactly what this says to me, is that in the real world, it's exactly where we are right now, only much, much better. And what would make this, where you are right now, much, much better? You know, you can think, well, you know, if I painted this room a different color, or, you know, if I had a, you know, $1 billion in the bank, or I, you know, you think about those things as what would make your world much, much better. But what Jesus tells us throughout the Course, the only way to make your world much, much better, and I got a little ding for that, the only way to make your world much, much better is to see it in the light, to see the truth of what it is, and to see it in the light, and to carry the light with you, which today's lesson talks about. That's when I get lost when he starts talking about the shadows and the, you know, the cave and all that kind of stuff, because it doesn't, I can't so much relate to it but I can definitely relate to being the light and carrying the light with me wherever I go, and shining the light and seeing the light. And in that way, everything that I see is much, much better.
Yeah, yeah. You know what comes to mind as you're sharing that, Lynn, is a story that I heard years ago that I always thought was had some great symbolic import, and that is one where someone was describing the difference between heaven and hell as there's this huge banquet with every conceivable kind of, you know, delicious delicacy spread out on endless banquet halls, and the only difference between heaven and hell is that they both have that, except in hell everyone is starving and emaciated because what's happened is they've been put into straitjackets. That the only thing that they can, or, you know, somehow constrained in such a way that they have these long poles, you know, strapped to one arm and the other arm bound, and at the end of the pole is a spoon. And because of the length of the pole, they can never reach their own mouth, and in both heaven and hell, this is the case with everyone. And I'm paraphrasing this greatly, but it's just the story anyway. But the only difference is in heaven is that everyone is well fed and happy, and in hell everyone's starved and emaciated and dying off. And what the people in heaven have learned to do is to feed each other, because their spoon can feed someone else, even if it can't reach their own mouth. And I think the analogy falls apart a bit, because in the Course's metaphysics, as we, if you will, nourish metaphorically ourselves and each other at the same time, it's a simultaneous thing, because it's really the world of thought rather than the world of form. So, you know, metaphor falls apart pretty quickly. But I think the idea is a good one, in that it basically reminds us that it's the shared interest rather than the separate interest that is really the reflection of the oneness, you know, our sameness, and the willingness to recognize that we're all in it together, and we need to help each other return to that place in the mind together. I think that's, you know, a pretty helpful metaphor. So anyway, in case that's helpful.
It is, absolutely. And that also reminds me of the lesson today, because the "let me remember I'm one with God," the only way that I remember I'm one with God is by remembering my connection to my brother. And
Yeah, in fact, that it concludes with, "Let me remember I'm one with God, at one with my brothers, with all my brothers and myself, in everlasting holiness and peace." And the "all my brothers" is really the key element there, because if we leave anyone or anything out, we're saying, you know, that part is unworthy and duality happened. And so we just need to be mindful of when we want to exclude, when we want to segregate and to, you know, delineate and essentially harbor biases and prejudices against so-called others, forgetting that not only does modern physics but ancient metaphysics and of course the miracles all you know, conspire wonderfully to inform us that it ain't so, and you know, we're all one thing, and there's no one out there, and we're all tagged, we're all it.
So. Exactly. And that's, you know, that again, it can't be reached by excluding others or any right. others. And that's, it's all inclusive. So, mm-hmm. you know, think about, you know, how many lessons do we have that say, you know, think about somebody you really don't like at all, and you know, try to see them, you know, filled with light, try to see them filled with love. You know, that's really, I mean, it's a simple exercise, but it absolutely does work. And the only reason that I would not want to do that is because I want to hold on to my grievance, and I want to stay outside of heaven. I want to keep myself separate, because, you know, I think that there is a difference that's so important that, you know, one of us must die, basically. So I wish death on both of us from that, you know.
Well, yeah, and it sounds crazy when you phrase it that way, and yet so much of the Course is phrased similarly, because Jesus wants to see the insanity, the ego, and how even the slightest condemnation is really full-scale nuclear warfare. There's really nothing, no difference between a hangnail and a Holocaust in our mind, and because any admission or recognition of duality destroys in our minds only. I'm trying to say those both at the same time, but not in truth. But for the duration of the time that we believe that we're separate, that appears to have taken effect, and we have overwhelming evidence in the world as interpreted by other egos, seemingly other egos, but really just reflections of our own choice for that crazy thought system, that seem to corroborate and confirm that. And yet, all it takes is one moment of kindness and recognition that, no, everyone, everything, every seeming particle from quarks to quasars, as I like to say, is all included in that, that oneness. Not the form, but the essence behind the form, and that awareness really is what leads us out of the dream, out of the cave, of using Ken's use of Plato's allegory of the cave that we just finished and talking about briefly, and how, you know, the darkness really is the darkness of the belief in separation, and the light is really the light of inclusion that leaves no one out. Scary's book Love Has Forgotten No One's title suggests. You know, we leave anyone or anything out, which is a challenging thing to do, and why we need to learn to forgive ourselves for wanting to leave certain groups or individuals out of our perfect forgiveness, our perfect holiness. And so today's workbook lesson, let me remember I'm one with God, at one with all my brothers and my capital S self, in everlasting holiness and peace. And if there's not a perfect innocence and holiness and peacefulness, that's the cognitive dissonance that the Course wants us to look at and to say, oh, well, gee, I had a whole bunch of thoughts today that didn't resonate with that at all. So I guess I still have some forgiveness work to do. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's important to notice that, because, you know, that really is what's holding you in this world. And, recognize that, kindness, you're giving, you're allowing, you're stepping back from the ego enough to reach out or to express love, or, you know, whatever it is that you do, even to acknowledge or admit that another person, you know, might be innocent, you know, might be, you know, worthy of forgiveness, the possibility that, you know, they might not be the, you know, evil, you know, jerk that you thought they were. That is really an investment on your part, you know. It's really an investment. You're putting yourself out of your own comfort zone, and what you think is keeping you safe is your rejection of all these jerks, and so it puts you in a position where, you know, now you are I don't even know how to say it. You've invested something in them. You've given them something that you really didn't think they deserved, just by trying to be nice to them. You know, that's the way the ego works. You know, it doesn't have to be the purest motive. You don't have to you know, be completely aligned with the Holy Spirit in order to give something to somebody you don't like. And the something you might give them is forgiveness. You might just say, okay, you know, I'm going to entertain the idea that you might be innocent, and therefore, you know, I'm going to offer you this thing I think you don't deserve, but, you know, just to see, just to give it a chance.
The classic forgiveness to destroy, as the Course describes it, which is really, you know, it's stopping at the ego's interpretation rather than saying, okay, there's the ego's interpretation that you know, something happened, and then immediately, or as quickly as possible, saying, okay, that obviously isn't cutting it because it's never worked before. How can I resolve this? And the only resolution that results in peace is to say, okay, Holy Spirit, I'm going to mess this up if I try to do this by myself as a seemingly separate self, because I'm going to, you know, base it on the values that that self has that are in conflict or in competition or different from the values that this other seemingly separate self has. And, you know, help me see the shared interest, which is that everyone is wanting, you know, you might say desperately, to go home and to be proven wrong, that their belief that they are separate and are capable of you know, committing crimes against each other or God or you know, oneness or whatever, it doesn't matter the target, in truth are impossible. On the level of form, it happens, you know, so frequently, you know, it fills the internet and
everything,
radio airwaves, just about anything we can think of. You know, there's full of examples of infractions of propriety and fairness, and you know, on and on and on. And you know, and so it's not saying, you know, don't look at the data of our senses, but just saying don't look at ego's interpretation as fact. Just recognize, okay, there's you know, things that happen at a level of form. This body was in this geographical location and it did these things, you know, and it, you know, it appeared to make these changes to its environment or whatever, you know. It moved some ones and zeros around and using a big squares of plastic on a little metal keyboard and a thing called a mouse, you know, or whatever. So we think those things are consequential. But in truth, the only thing that's consequential is, am I choosing peace and the teacher of peace, or am I choosing the teacher of condemnation? And moment to moment, we get to decide. And the challenging thing is, too, when we catch ourselves, particularly over extended periods of having chosen the teacher of condemnation, to say, wait a minute, I remember, I found that there was another option here, and I can choose against that, not in a condemning way, but I can just say, that isn't working. I know that no matter what the situation is, I can choose peace. I can see peace instead of this. And I'm not upset for the reason that I think, because I'm not upset because of something happened for him. I'm upset because I chose the wrong teacher in my mind. And that teacher is always going to you know, run the blame throw, or as it's one of its primary weapons, and you know, scorch the earth with its condemnations of everything and everyone. Including ourselves.
You know, absolutely.
It's a package deal, right?
It is a package deal. So it's that willingness, the first recognition that maybe I'm not doing the right, the way that I should be doing it, and then the willingness to see it differently and to allow, to forgive. That's really the important thing, is once you have that little bit of willingness, then the rest of it just flows through, because it's just opening the door, you know, you're opening the window to let some air come through, you know. Well, if you really want to get a breeze going through, open another window, and then a lot of air comes through. So it's that openness and that willingness to accept the correction, which is the atonement, the willingness to accept the atonement, the correction of our thinking. And it doesn't matter, really, honestly, if your motive is as pure as, you know, the driven snow or whatever. It doesn't matter, because it's the willingness, you know, that is necessary. The motive, you know, comes later as you begin to see the result of that willingness to heal. Then you become, you do have so much support. You get so much, you know, and Jesus actually says that, you know, if it weren't for all the help that we get, the support we get from the universe and our brothers and the Christ, and, you know, if that wasn't behind us, angels and all, then we would probably give up. But because we have all of these willing and helping us and opening things up for us and showing us things, we become more and more willing because we see a result, you know. So I know that's what's happening.
And the result is in our mind.
Yes.
By, I can interject there.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Because I think that's so easy to think. Oh well, that means that all I have to do is choose the right teacher, and you know, my health, and biologically, and my finances, and my relationships, and the global ecology, and you know, politics, and everything is suddenly going to be transformed with the, you know, magic wand, Pollyanna, you know, sparkles and all that kind of stuff. It's not talking about that at all. It's just saying we will see them differently, because we will see them as a classroom to get back to our mind, to get back to the place where, you know, we're essentially rewinding ego's script and replacing it with Holy Spirit's translation, which is saying, you know, you have never left perfect oneness. Everyone has never left perfect oneness. And that is the only place where we, you know, are motivated to reach out and use the spoons at the end of our arm, to use that previous story of heaven and hell, and to feed each other out of kindness rather than in terms of, you know, thinking that we have to, it's all on our own you know, life is tough and then you die. That kind of, you know, thinking. But that's you know, it takes a lot of practice, and we need to be really, really patient with ourselves as we go through that.
Absolutely, we do. And, you know, it does and it doesn't. Because what happens is that as you begin to see with the Holy Spirit, what you see instead of the suffering that you once saw, you begin to see something entirely different, and you begin to see the reality of the person, the being in their situation, and or yourself in your situation. You begin to see it in a much different way, and where once you thought things were just horrible and unfixable, you begin to actually see, no, nothing needs to be fixed. And everything is perfect just the way it is. It doesn't appear that way to the mind, to the ego, because the ego sees that there are differences and that, you know, some things are bigger and harder and worse, and some things are better. But, you know, Jesus tells us there is no order of difficulty in miracles. And what he is saying with that is that all things are the same in effect as any other thing, and that the miracle is not beyond any of it. The miracle is in every bit of it and behind every bit of it. And so when you see a situation that you think is unbearable, that something that you can't, you know, you can't stand, you think is so terrible and so sad or so evil or so whatever, you must recognize that there is a miracle there that's waiting for you, and ask to be shown the miracle. And when you see the miracle, you will no longer see the situation as being something that you don't want. You begin to see the situation as just a situation, and having no real effect on people or planet or animal or air or anything, no real effect at all. Asking to see the miracle at that point is really essential to, you know, recognizing there's nothing here to fear, and that, you know, that belief in fear is really, you know, that's the thing that keeps us from looking, keeps us from asking. So, you know, the sun has risen over it. How can a shadow keep you from the sun? You know?
Yeah, and the shadow is just the darkness in our mind that is just a symbol of believing in separate interests, believing in a frail, uncertain, lonely, you know, thought system and identity. And instead of the glorious one that today's workbook lesson talks about, where we realize, you know, we actually can afford to be in perfect peace and share that with everyone we meet. Not necessarily in words all the time, but in terms of a gentleness and a kindness with which we interact with everyone. And that's really the light that's being talked about here, which again is a metaphor. It has nothing to do with ultraviolet, infrared, the visible spectrum, or down to radio waves, or up to cosmic radiation. It's nothing about that at all. It's about the light in the mind that is, you know, a metaphor for going beyond the cognitive dissonance. And as I was sharing that term, which is like when I learned in a psychology class years ago, I'm sure most of the time when people hear that term, they think of, you know, stuff in the brain that's conflicting. But here it's a spiritual cognitive dissonance that A Course in Miracles is asking us to look at, because it's not talking about having the Lynns and the Bruces that are involved in this conversation or who might be listening choose against the ego, because they're not going to do it. I mean, we don't, as seemingly separate selves, we don't choose against ourselves, but we can pretend to do that. But where the Course is really pitched at, and I think this is one of the really brilliant points that Ken Wapnick makes over and over in different ways, is that the Course is addressed to the decision-making faculty in the mind, that if you can, you know, if you've seen his chart, is really the blue dot that's above the world of form and above the two thought systems that reflect in the world of form as well. And it's really just the choice of what teacher am I going to have at any given moment. And it's really that awareness that we took with us into the dream, you know, the first split, as Ken would say, that is, you know, where the Course is pitched at. It's pitched at that part of us that deep down inside knows that there is a better way and knows that the only way out of it is complete kindness and abandonment of what doesn't work. and so, you know, we'll get to it eventually. We'll you know, go exhaust our bucket lists of things in the world that we want to try and approaches, you know, inspired by ego's special love-hate relationships and all the crazy things that it tries to you know, stave off the boredom, fear, anger, guilt, and intrinsic sinfulness that it thinks is possible and is bought into, and just recognize, oh, in truth, that is not possible. But we don't get at that directly. We get it by letting go of our belief and allowing it to be replaced. Right? So.
Exactly.
Do you want to read on?
Yeah. Let's see. Where did we end up?
I think the quote, "Every miracle is but the end of an illusion," is
okay.
It's the top of page 55.
All right. There we go. All right. So every miracle is but the end of an illusion. Such was the journey. So that's what I'm saying. When you ask for the miracle, when you see an illusion, something you don't know, ask for a miracle, and it will end it.
Yeah.
Such was the journey, such as its ending, and in the goal of truth, which you accepted, must all illusions end. Following the course, we may use... that was from the Obstacles to Peace, and this is Ken now talking about that quote. Following the course, we may use the image of a ladder, referred to above in Chapter 1, to symbolize the ego's descent from God, as well as the Holy Spirit's correction, which leads us back to God. Since the separation never happened in reality, all that seemed to occur from the onset of the tiny mad idea is illusory, and therefore the correction accomplished by the miracle must be illusory as well. The whole journey, then, is unreal, and it must end as it began. This is why Jesus speaks of the atonement process as a, quote, journey without distance, from text chapter 8, section 7, or 6. And in the manual for teachers, he speaks of the world. Can what has no beginning really end? The world will end in an illusion as it began. Yet will its ending be an illusion of mercy, the illusion of forgiveness complete, excluding no one, limitless in gentleness, will cover it, hiding all evil, concealing all sin, and ending guilt forever. So ends the world that guilt has made, for now it has no purpose and is gone. So that's it. The end of sin, guilt, and fear is the end of the world.
As you're saying that, reading that quote from the manual, section 14, I was thinking how the Course itself, because we are so steeped in dualistic thinking, has to use dualist language, And so the words that kind of make sense to us where we think we're at, you know, limitless and gentleness will cover it. Hiding all evil, concealing all sin, and ending guilt forever. Those almost kind of assume that those took place because we think they did. You know, we think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin, as Lesson 93 starts out, after the heading or the title of the lesson. And so, you know, because we think those are real, the Course meets us where we think we're at and says, well, it'll hide it. Well, it never happened in the first place. Concealing all sin and ending guilt forever. Those things never happen either. There's nothing to conceal. So what it's really saying is that from the standpoint of that thought system, those things are hidden and concealed, meaning you're not going to find them. I mean, they just vanish in the same way that light vanishes darkness, you know, in metaphoric terms. This is a more literal meaning of light. If we're speaking from this perspective of the Course, not from where it's trying to meet us, is, you know, it never happened. So from the pure non-dual, you know, fundamental thinking of the Course, if it didn't happen, then there's nothing to conceal, nothing to hide. So again, the Course takes artistic license with a lot of language and tries to meet us where we think we're at and says things that are comforting so that we'll continue on and, you know, not freak out when we realize, oh, I'm actually dismantling an insane thought system that is sort of my entire identity as I've come to know it from birth, you know, and beyond that from countless lifetimes. But we're really undoing the whole belief in separation, aren't we?
Exactly. Yeah, undoing it. And you know, I'm looking at this quote, and he's talking about that it will cover, that the illusion of forgiveness will cover everything. And and in this Obstacles to Peace, what he talks about are the things that keep what peace can't flow over. You know, there's a lot of covering and flowing over of things here. And I think, you know, it sounds like kind of, you know, a cover up, but really it's just replacing what was there. You know, it's just replacing what you think was there with a truth or a greater truth than what is what is actually in the illusion. So I love that. Can what has no beginning really end? The world will end in an illusion as it began. That's a pretty cool thing to know.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
So,
shall we read on?
Yeah. Let's see. My cat was at the door wanting to go out. I might have to run down and open the door and let him go.
Okay.
So why don't you read for a minute and I'll...
Sure. Okay. So we're left off in the middle of page 55 in the print version of Ken's wonderful book, The Journey Home. And he resumes with, a parallel passage to the ones on the ladder is found at the end of the, quote, the substitute reality, unquote, in chapter 18. Here we also find the statement that the Holy Spirit's guidance leads us back through the maze of illusions we made as a substitute for the simple clarity of the truth and to which we are gently led if we but take his hand. And now he's quoting from chapter 18, section 1, paragraph 8, sentence 3 through 5. The Holy Spirit takes you gently by the hand and retraces with you your mad journey outside yourself, leading you gently back to the truth and safety within. He brings all your insane projections and the wild substitutions that you have placed outside you to the truth. Thus he reverses the course of insanity and restores you to reason. And there's a metaphor that Ken uses in one of his talks that I think is brilliant. And he talks about the labyrinth as the metaphor and the golden thread. I think maybe I'm mixing two different metaphors, perhaps, but I think this might be the same one. Anyway, the idea of if you're going to go into a cave or a labyrinth or some sort of a maze, if you tie a string at the opening where you go in to something solid, you know, and then and you've got some sturdy string, and you unravel it as you go in. In theory, you should be able to, you know, travel it backwards and find your way out. Well, in a sense, that's kind of what Holy Spirit does. And when we listen to ego's judgment and counsel, it basically brings us to a darker, more divided, more divisive place in the mind. With each step, we go darker and darker and further into the cavernous labyrinth of its insane thought system. However, once we recognize that there's a better way, thank you, Helen and Bill, we start using the exact same thread, but we hand over hand it in the opposite direction. Instead of going, you know, into the abyss, we climb out of it by that dark thread becomes a golden thread and a glowing luminous one that then takes us out the way we came. And each person, each seemingly separate self, has a different path. And that's why, you know, we can't judge another's path. We don't know if they're 10 feet from the opening of their cave or 10, you know, parsecs, you know, light years or whatever. I mean, we have no idea. So, because we're all clueless and we have just such a partial view of things that we really don't know, you know, what's best for anyone else. All we can do is listen to our teacher and say, hey, take that thread and put your, you know, grab it the other direction with your hands, and now it becomes a glowing thread that lights your way out of that darkness. And in case those metaphors are helpful, I really like that one particularly, just because it seems like it's a good visual to remind me that whenever I forgive, whenever I let anybody off the hook, I'm using the very same circumstances to turn it around. I'm taking, you know, where the rubber meets the road, as dear teachers Art and Persis say, and using everything as a forgiveness classroom instead of a prison.
Isn't that amazing? What a gift.
Yeah. Do you want to read from The Little Insane Wish?
Yeah, let me find it here. Okay. The Little Insane Wish to get rid of him with a capital H, whom with a capital W. The little insane wish to get rid of him whom you invited in and push him with a capital H out must produce conflict. And I love this because it's the idea that, yes, I was the one who wanted to kick him out. I'm the one who wants to reject my brother. I'm the one who wants to think that they are a maniac. You know, I'm the one. It's my own little wish. And, of course, it's going to produce conflict because I know that really who I'm pushing out is the Christ. Really, yeah. Who I'm pushing out is my own best friend.
Exactly. That cognitive dissonance between, you know, the truth of what we are, which is unity, and the lie that we've all bought into and you know, are propagandists for, as we're following ego's dictates, is of duality. You know, that cognitive dissonance is really the, you know, the bedrock of the course's curriculum in terms of its approach to having us get back to our right minds by seeing the insanity of the ego's thinking. And so that's why there's got to be conflict. And it's not necessarily easy. It's simple because really there really is no conflict in truth, and that's where we get to. But it seems sometimes outrageously challenging because we've invested so much of our identity in reinforcing the thought system of conflict. So it's, give yourself some time. Be patient.
Right. And it's our ideas of what's right and wrong and what's good and bad and what...
All that stuff.
It's all the thoughts that we have that are the judgment the of our perception of the world. And so, you know, this is why it's so insidious. Because your mind, the ego, will tell you you're being a good person by condemning bad people. You know, it's you're a loving person if you don't accept, you know, murderers into your home. You know, what loving person would want to bring a maniac into their midst? And I'm not talking about, you know, murders of other people or anything, murders of minds and souls, and you know, we we look around and we make up our decision about, you know, how valuable or how valueless others are in their thoughts and their lives. And when we perceive that someone has a valueless life, then we don't want to associate with them. We only associate with people that have some value to us, that can give us something, whether it's validation as a human or it's an opportunity to, you know, show what a good person I am by helping you out, or, you know, the ego has false motives. And the ego's motives are all about self grandization, you know, making the self the ruler of the world. And the only way the self can be the ruler of the world is if everything else in the world is beneath it. Everything else in the world, nothing in the world is equal with it. And that, you know, that's what we do every day. We have our own little kingdoms and our own little selves, and we decide what's good and bad and what's right and wrong, what we like and we don't like. And it could be the way your hair is cut, or it could be, you know, the color of your skin, or the accent when you speak, or the language that you speak, or whatever it is, you know. And consciously we may be saying, I love everyone, but, you know, I was at a party at Easter and one of the guys was asking me, you know, about things, and I said, yeah, I love everyone. And he said, oh, do you love Trump? And I stopped. I was like, you know, no. I'm a liar. because I recognize, you know, how much I condemn that person, and I'm afraid of that person, and I think that person is dangerous, and that person is harmful to the country and the world. And, you know, I have all these decisions that I've made about the character of this being, and, you know, and yet here I'm sitting here, you know, telling these guys, oh, I love everybody. Well, how can I have any faith or trust in a mind that can think like that? You know,
yeah, and I think the challenge is that, you know, we need to remember again the level of confusion that is so, you know, part and parcel of the ego strategy of keeping us mindless is to basically say it's always about the behavior, because A Course in Miracles is really founded on the idea that our true identity, our true innocence, our true holiness has nothing to do with bodies, form, or personas, or the silly, seemingly separate selves that we, you know, relate to and identify with. It basically says that our real nature as one being that appears to take different forms, appears to inhabit different bodies and have different life stories, including some that are presidents and some that are paupers and some that are, you know, undertakers and ditch diggers and others that are bank presidents and CEOs it has no bearing on the reality that we're just all this one thing, but we've become very sophisticated in separating and distinguishing different forms. But in truth, the real self that I have is the same as yours and the same as Jesus and Hitler's and Trump's and Gandhi's and you know, pick any name, and it's got to be all the same thing. Now, on the level of form, the behavior is wildly different. And typically, the behavior, based on how often we're choosing one thought system over the other, will appear to be, at times, strongly identified with kindness, and other times strongly identified with narcissistic, you know, pathological lying self-interest, you know, just to pick a couple of adjectives. but all of our egos are complete pathological liars and narcissists all the time, 24/7. So I think the point is that if we condemn any particular person on the basis of behavior, we can certainly recognize the behavior and not deny the behavior and be, you know, upfront about the fact that, you know, that this is not behavior that I would choose or endorse on the level of form. But that has nothing to do with the spirit that's behind the person participating in those behaviors. And I think that inexorably every single letter and word in A Course in Miracles is leading us back to is to say, our eyes deceive us, and trust not your good intentions and your intention, your motivations and your values based on, evaluating as egos what's good and bad in the world. It's not going to work for us.
Exactly.
or even short term very often.
No, it doesn't work at all ever. And the reason is because what I'm seeing in that other is my own mind.
Exactly.
So I'm not seeing anything in that other that's something else. I'm not seeing anything in that other that's another person. What I'm seeing is my own mind that I'm projecting out. And there's really not another being behind him that is the Christ. It is me. It's all me. Every bit of it. And so what I am, the Christ, is one thing. There's no individual beings that are the Christ. Christ is one thing. What I'm seeing is what I'm projecting on the Christ. So I'm projecting Trump, and I'm projecting Bruce, and I'm projecting, everyone who's listening. I'm projecting Lynn. I'm projecting Lynn's world. All of it is a projection of my mind, and so I'm the one who decides what it is. I'm the one that decides the rules, what's good, what's bad, and you agree with me or disagree with me because you are me too. And these are the conflicts of my own mind. Yeah, exactly. Let's see. Does the next stone start a parallel passage, or did I miss a page?
I think we're on the little insane wish.
The little insane wish to get rid of him whom you invited in and push him out must produce conflict. This is an important idea and is talked about in many different places in A Course in Miracles. Our natural state is to be with the Holy Spirit or Jesus, resting in peace with them. There is a part of us that yearns for that state of oneness. There is also a part of us, however, that wants nothing more than to preserve our individual identity and existence, no matter what the cost. This is the true conflict, and one cannot go in two different directions simultaneously without feeling this conflict. Jesus explains the situation of trying to follow both the ego's curriculum and the Holy Spirit's at the same time. And this is a quote from A Course in Miracles. The curriculum of the atonement is the opposite of the curriculum you have established for yourself, but so is its outcome. If the outcome of yours has made you unhappy, and if you want a different one, a change in the curriculum is obviously necessary. The first change to be introduced is a change in direction. A meaningful curriculum cannot be inconsistent. If it is planned by two teachers, each believing in diametrically opposed ideas, it cannot be integrated. If it is carried out by these two teachers simultaneously, each one merely interferes with the other. It's like Congress and the Senate. This leads to fluctuation, but not to change. The volatile have no direction. They cannot choose one because they cannot relinquish the other, even if it does not exist. Their conflicted curriculum teaches them that all directions exist and gives them no rationale for choice. And the total senselessness of such a curriculum must be fully recognized before a real change in direction becomes possible. You cannot learn simultaneously from two teachers who are in total disagreement about everything. Their joint curriculum presents an impossible learning task. They are both teaching you entirely different things in entirely different ways, which might be possible, except that both are teaching you about yourself. Your reality is unaffected by both, but if you listen to both, your mind will be split about what your reality is. And that's from text chapter 8, section 1.
And good stuff, huh?
Yeah, really good stuff. No wonder we're so confused.
When you mentioned Congress, and I was thinking, the only thought system that's incongruous, pun intended, is the thought system of the ego, because it tries to reconcile darkness with light, tries to reconcile insanity with sanity. It tries to make duality work. And it's really, I mean, this is a non-trivial distinction between a lot of other metaphysical systems. Did we read or talk about the email that came out from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles recently about New Age thinking? And
you mentioned it.
It's quite good. It's quite good. I'll have to send the link. Maybe we should, you know, talk about that at some point, because I think it really clarifies a lot of the difference between, and it's just a short thing that Ken wrote. There's like five or six paragraphs kind of thing. A lot of the primary differences between, you know, so much New Age thinking, which there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's kind of how I got to the course, was through, you know, the New Age buffet, you know, metaphysical buffet line kind of thing. And finally, I said, you know, I haven't looked at that. Those three blue books on my mom's shelf, and I knew about them in the late 70s and finally picked them up in the mid-80s. I was like, oh, man, this is starting to make sense here. On some level, I didn't quite fully understand. Now, I'm still, you know, just unraveling, but with the help of Ken and teachers inspired by him largely, you know, it's like, oh, it's starting to work. It's starting to make sense, because, you know, the duality is really just, you know, at the foundation of the insanity that keeps us in conflict. And I think that's why, you know, Ken's brilliant writing here, an example of, you know, the two curriculums, and how only one of them is going to work, is really helpful. Because our ego is incongruous all the time. It's not congruent with the truth at all, and in fact, it's not even, you know, it can't even reconcile the conflicts within itself, because it's based on a dream or an illusion or a lie about reality. And so, but that doesn't mean our mind isn't powerful. We made up a whole cosmos, an entire, you know, material universe, just for the purpose of hiding out from that reality in the mind that we never left. How nuts was that?
Yeah. And what we did when we made this universe and this world, what we made was a world of choice. And we gave ourselves choices about things. And with that world of choice came, like, almost unlimited possibilities. And, you know, fortunately, it's not unlimited possibilities. It's almost, because, you know, God did put a limit on our ability to miscreate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we couldn't make enough possibilities that could actually destroy us, but we made enough possibilities that we could definitely be in hell for, you know, billions of years and billions more. I mean, we could continue to wander in this dream for, you know, a long period of time. Fortunately, the more we recognize that this is a dream, which is really what I began to see is very clearly on a regular basis. This is a dream. These choices are dream choices. This idea is a dream idea. You know, there's really nothing right or wrong about any part of it. It is a dream. You know, you have a dream at night, you wake up, you know, you don't go back and blame yourself for being the person you were in the dream. You know, you murdered somebody in your dream. You don't say, oh, I'm a murderer now, take me to jail. You know, you recognize that, you know, that was a dream and nothing really happened. And that's what we're going to recognize, and we can recognize it every day. This is a dream and nothing is really happening. So there's no real effect.
It's a massive Game of Thrones fantasy that we're acting out in our mind. And the thrones are illusory, just as are the castles and the kingdoms. And there's really no real winner in a battlefield scenario where part of perfect oneness appears to be pitted against itself. You know, it's just insanity.
It's just insanity. But we are no longer wholly insane.
Yeah.
So we're ready for that.
And we're also on the level of the dream, out of time for this week. So I want to say thank you again, Glenn, as always, for sharing an hour with me. And I always enjoy our conversations, and particularly, you know, I'm so grateful that we've, you know, both resonate with Ken's work and find inspiration from it and like to share it. So.
Yeah, and thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. I love you with all my heart, and I'm so grateful for your decision to join. You know, how lucky we are. All right. Well, I'll see you next week, and I'm going to stop the recording.